Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
Hey, February 23rd, 2021. Technically, this isn't the Daily Wrap-Up, but since I used that opening graphic, let's just go ahead and roll with it. So thank you for joining me today, Johnny Vedmore, because you had a fantastic article that just came out that I'm dying to talk about. And it's something that was really, I mean, it was something that I'm actually shocked that nobody else has talked about. It's something that is, it's before we even get into the discussion of the article today, it's something that's been rattling around in my mind, the idea of the world we live in, where we talk about censorship, and yet we're able to do this. Right? People can hear us. People can tune in. So they go, how can you be censored? How can you be restricted if we're listening to you right now? But it's a different scenario today where, yes, we're here. But in some cases, unless they know the exact URL or, you know, or we're in a dark corner that they can't reach. Right? And if you search for the topics we're discussing, no matter how popular it is, Google will make sure it won't pop up. So in this discussion today, there's some information around Klaus Schwab and his family that ties back to some really alarming things that seem to contradict a lot of the things they're pushing today around the Great Reset and all of this, yet it's just not seen because of that exact that point that Johnny was able to find where these things are. And obviously there's a lot of scrubbing and things we'll get into as well today that make that harder to see. So before we get into the article, what are your thoughts on that? And why do you think this stuff hasn't been seen? And how did you come across it?
Well, it's a failure of the mainstream media. Of course, that's what nearly everything, the problem today is that we have a mainstream media that doesn't hold anybody to account and hides away from the big stories. My experience of that, I've had a lot of experience of that since I started, because I started writing probably more seriously in about 2015. But then I got into the investigate. I found my place. I was looking for my place, and my place is very much going really deep into people's history. And I thought that's what investigative journalists are meant to do. Hmm. I thought, you know, I'm going to have to find things that no one else found. And I found the best way for me to work was to skirt on the boundaries, to report the stuff that the mainstream media won't touch, but that the independent media hasn't found out yet, etc. And so try and find between the lines of that paradigm of censored or free journalism, see if I can like skirt it. One of my first major articles was one on Theresa May's father just before the election and how he worked with a famous serial killer called John Bodkin Adams. Now, the fact that he worked with a famous serial killer doesn't make him a bad man. You know, the story's wider than that. It's got much more breadth because it's a lot related to the independent child sexual abuse inquiry in the UK. But that should have been picked up by mainstream media. It was coming up to election day, and I'd said, well, no one looks into Theresa May, so there's a gap. And that was where I first kind of recognized the niche of this area of research that isn't done by most people, because most people kind of look at things in a linear perspective anyway. They tend to look at a story and say, I've got to write the story about this, rather than going, I'm going to learn about what was actually happening and get into that, get into the time and place, develop that more. And I think that's another reason this problem is it would be too many funds allocated to mainstream media journalists and too much time taken out. They like their quick sort of journalism where it's like 30 minutes, four people on a show all arguing with each other, or they do an investigative piece which is just like is repeated over and over the whole breadth of the mainstream media. But you don't have any of it. There's so much material out there to investigate. There's so many bad things that have happened that do not get reported because of the paradigm we've been living in for a long time. Right. There is a massive, and I keep saying this, I said this throughout the time that I've been giving any interviews with everybody for maybe 3-4 years. People can do this. People who have just got their little bits of skill set of looking down their family trees or have experienced that, you can develop these skills more and more, and you can find lots of dirty alleyways to go down in investigative journalism world, because all of these people are corrupt as hell, and corrupt people, birds of a feather, do flock together.
Right.
This is why Go on, sorry.
Well, I was going to say that we see this happening today right now quite a bit with the, you know, New York Times saying critical thinking is the problem. The Forbes saying, no, don't do your own research. Listen to the experts. Yeah. You know? And it's the same point, is they want you to be dependent on their information flow and not think for yourself, which is what this article really kind of shows you. What you're describing here is that this stuff is just waiting for people like yourself to do your due diligence, which is what they're telling you not to do today, and dig into it.
And I think people are scared of tackling things like ancestry of the famous people because of a couple of the myths of, like, well, their father's crimes aren't necessarily the son's crimes. And it's true. The father's crimes aren't necessarily the son's crime. But if you see a dodgy father and you follow the son down, more than likely than not, he's taken in his walking in his father's footsteps. Because unfortunately,
well, at the very least, it's relevant.
Because psychological beasts we are, we automatically are affected by our past and by our parents heavily. Of course, we know this. And a lot of men end up and some of them not wanting to, but walk their own father's paths. And there's a lot of that, I think, within mainstream media tends to be, you see this idea of dynasties, the same as you see in politics, the same as you see in all of these controlled parts. It's all dynasty. And this, when I did the Klaus Schwab investigation, that was one thing that came up, multiple family dynasties that were existed within these areas, and that existed for a very long time, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's bring this into the article you're discussing for those that maybe didn't read the title today on the show. But before we do that, actually, and I'll bring it up on the screen. Before we do that, though, I'm realizing right now that there's a lot of people out there that probably don't know how, have seen you yet or know where you're working today. And I'm assuming that they probably do because your work has been fantastic. And I think for those that don't, make sure you begin following Johnny Vedmore. But please let us know where you're now writing and how you ended up there and you know, why you're passionate about this today.
Well, I mean, when I first started writing, I looked for an independent platform and I found a place called vocal.media, which was independent at the time before they started floating and doing all of the financial stuff and started then putting like little bits above my investigations. I was reporting fact, and they were starting to put up the, this hasn't been fact checked and some misinformation isn't our fault and et cetera, so I was already desperate to get away from that place because unfortunately there's no place that will employ someone like me doing what I do. I'm really what I was when I started out, and I was until fairly recently, is just a normal hotel worker doing full-time shift to be able to afford to live, maintaining a life and trying to do all of that, but realizing he really needs to write about this stuff more and more and more. And it's not like becoming an obsession, because I've really been able to parcel it off in my life. But I realized it is.
Just make a note really quick on that point, right? It's this is the kind of thing that it shouldn't be all encompassing. But when you recognize somebody who is, I mean, the idea that you can have a full time job and still do this kind of work, major respect there. I say that about a lot of content creators today on YouTube or elsewhere that have full time jobs and families, and yet they still produce content like this. But it shows you that you are willing, at least, you know, in general, to potentially sacrifice what you're doing to get this information out. You know what I mean? Like, you know, because it does affect your job and what else you're doing. And and just because of that passion, it developed into something that is, you know, that you can make a career out of. And it's much different than what we see with the media mainstream today, where it's more so about what is acceptable and what will get them pats on the head from the elitist circles. And so, you know, I just want to point that out, that drive is what makes what this independent media. Right. It's by and large, in my opinion, the honest stuff driven by the desire to expose the truth for the good of the people that are being manipulated by the mainstream. And that's what I think this is. So please continue.
Well, I think there's certain hobbies that one takes up in life that they you start to learn about parceling parts off and space off and saying like, oh, I've got this much time to do this and this much time to do that. And that develops over time to make you realize that you can do more things than you think you can do if you organize organize it well enough, but you've got to organize yourself. So I spent the first probably like 15 years of my adult life really wanting to do this sort of stuff, but thinking I've got a full-time job, I've got a partner and all of these things, I've got all of the bills to pay and etc. I want to go on holiday now and again, etc., etc. So I don't have time to do this. So maybe one day I can make a bit of money from my job and I can go and I can do this full time. Mm-hmm. But that it doesn't, like, life doesn't work like that. And if you actually look at the progress of your own writing abilities or your own investigative abilities, you always start off smaller than the scope you end up looking at. So it actually fits in really well when you start learning to do something like this and learning to look around, to do these things really slowly while you're doing other things to help maintain healthy mental state, because you need, as humans, you need like multiple things going on so you can remain interested in life. Because if you don't, and you put all your eggs in that one basket, then it can all fall apart. My journey to here has been like I went through giving interviews like this, and all my interviews were being taken down because of a lady who's an Epstein associate who goes to court and even takes YouTube to court. She doesn't just like, they don't just strike the channel down. They take YouTube to court in various European mainland countries, not taking me to court in the UK, because if they did, they'd be seen through, but they use their legal power, and she's, obviously, she's got access to billions. Like, she's one of those because her husband's an oil baron and, you know, all of that stuff. So I got censored really heavily. Every interview I was given, and for a while, I was just really depressed about doing video stuff. And so I kind of stopped on that, focused in on doing the writing for a bit and improving my own skills until I could get to a state where I can fight back against these people again to that level, because they just kept censoring me. And now the situation has turned out to be quite in a sense beneficial, because there's another community growing out of the censored people.
Absolutely. I see that as well. I mean, it's really clear right now that, I mean, of course they're still trying to push the narrative that the majority is what they want you to think it is, but I clearly believe that a huge faction of people, both in the United States and elsewhere in the world in general, are beginning to see what this is. Not just this one thing, not just even COVID-19, but it's beginning to expand. Sort of how I pointed out that I felt like cannabis, you know, decade ago, and still to this point, was, you know, there was this weird kind of revolution that happened where the states were like, you know what, we're just not listening to your law anymore. And that really did show people, look, you know, especially if we can come over the two-party illusion and actually come together about our values, we can push back against this monolithic power. And that's sort of, this article is really important in this regard, because it shows us this line, this connection through time of these people that are continuing these agendas, this, you know, the mindset of what they're trying to accomplish that evolves over time with technology and whatever else. And you can see, and I thought it was one of the threads throughout your article, that you're showing that there's this point they're trying to reach, this agenda that is, you know, whether it's even really materialized, it's something that you can see they've continued to drive for, you know? Mm-hmm. And now that we have this new technological revolution, nanotechnology and all this stuff coming out, all of a sudden it is now is the time. And that's what it feels like. So bringing this into the article today, the title is Schwab Family Values. And even just to read the opening paragraph you have to set the tone, it says, is the real Klaus Schwab a kindly old uncle figure wishing to do good for humanity? Or is he really the son of a Nazi collaborator who used slave labor and aided Nazi efforts to obtain the first atomic bomb? Right? I mean, I'm sure you probably know if you're watching this interview, which one is probably where that ended up. so let's get into, you know, and by the way, I want to point out that there's the way that you walk through the information on this and go through the timeline of the progression of the family and the fields of work. It's just really in depth walking through of the family, which is important for the larger picture in general. But so where did you start off on this? And what was the first thing that kind of, you know, open this up for you in regard to the Nazi angle and the family and how difficult was it to find the stuff that, as you pointed out, was scrubbed and censored and sanitized, as you put it?
Well, first of all, I've got to say, this is on Unlimited Hangout. That's where I'm writing now. That's my new home, because I don't get censored on Unlimited Hangout at all. I get to write the article as I like. I mean, this was in a sense, the boss, Whitney, she said, listen, you're good at the ancestry stuff. you're into all of this, it's a no-brainer that we have a little look into Klaus Schwab, see what we can find. And of course, it's obvious. That's easy for me to get interested into looking at this stuff because now I've got a thirst for it. I've built that thirst up over years. At first, my abilities were, and I didn't know where I was going. My abilities were and skills were weak when I was doing this work. But now I'm at a stage where I can really, I know what the process is going to be like. So the process was seriously spending about 2 to 3 weeks looking at everything that could possibly mention the names. So looking through Swiss newspaper archives, German archives. Of course, the first thing you've got to do is look at the speculation and the rumors. You look at what people think. They're never what they turn out to be at the end. There was people who thought that there was a guy called I think his name's something like Joseph Schwab, and he was the secretary of Hitler. And people really were like, oh, I'm sure it's probably this guy because he was the secretary of Hitler, so that makes sense, you know. And it's that simple. But we're dealing with an area called Schwabia. Upper Schwabia, and the Schwabs lived in Schwabia, and a lot of the people, the Jewish immigrants fleeing, or refugees fleeing the pogroms in Russia during the 1800s, would also take the name of regions where they settled, so that they wouldn't necessarily stand out as much, because these areas had massive amounts of anti-Semitism, but less anti-Semitism than the area just over there. So they were running for more anti-Semitism from the fire, frying pan, eventually into the fire. Like, you know, truly. The thing is about this article, it's got such a wide scope. You've got to start at the very beginning and work out who his family was. So I had Klaus Schwab, and I had to work backwards. Mm-hmm. And finding out his father's name, the rumors were easier. To find out the fact and see it written down in official documentation was harder to come across. Eventually, with on the family side of the front, to work out his ancestry, I came across a document which wasn't marked up as Klaus Schwab or anything, or family history, but it was a document that was someone that had taken a scan of a Swiss court document from 1950, where Eugene Schwab applied for Swiss citizenship again. So 5 years after the war, after his experiences in the war that we can talk about, he's trying to get away from Germany and go back to Switzerland. So obviously things have changed for Eugene Schwab.
This actually isn't the correct document, I think, but I just want to pull up and show that for those interested, which you should be, this article is incredibly well sourced with, you know, all the things he's pointing out. I just want to show you that, you know, this is something. I don't believe you actually have an image of that document in the article, do you?
Yeah. Well, not an image, but I actually start explaining the family, the very first after the intro, the very first link is that document. So if you scroll down a little bit from there and get to the bit where it's talking about 1870 in Karlsruhe, so the actual, the Schwabian story, the first link there, I think that's the one.
In any case, though, I just want to point out that
here you go.
This is the important stuff that people need today. You know, because the problem, what they want to train you, it actually back to the point you made in the beginning, to the very point, the media is right now trying to engineer you to think, well, we shouldn't even do this because my feeble mind can't understand what this stuff is. We have to trust the mainstream media. So it's always important. Everyone out there, those who watch my show know this well enough by now, that it's more important to you to go to the source material, read it for yourself and understand, not just take someone's word for it. And that's why this article is fantastic. So I just want to point that out. So please continue.
Why it takes a long time to actually do an article like this. And what you're looking at here is a Swiss federal document from 1950. Now, it's a rundown of multiple court cases. So the main bulk in the middle is about referring to Eugene Schwab, who is Klaus Schwab's father. He mentions Klaus Schwab and Urs Rainer Schwab, who are the children involved. It talks about Gottfried Schwab's original decision. That's Gottfried Schwab is the grandfather, a Klaus mm-hmm. Schwab, the father of Eugene. And in 1870, he was born in Karlsruhe in Germany, in the south of Germany, in Baden-Württemberg or near Baden-Baden. And his decision when he was about 23 was to seemingly emigrate to, well, definitely emigrate to Switzerland. So he had to give up his German citizenship. Not really his German citizenship. It was still like the Duchy of Baden citizenship. And he had to go down to the Swiss and reclaim new citizenship in Switzerland. But something happened in that process where he ended up going back before that process had finished and asking for a German citizenship back after he had had a child, Eugene Schwab, and got married to a woman called Marie Lepert. That was 1898 and 1899. Those two events happened. So he had moved to Switzerland as a baker, but by the time he's having his children and moving back to Germany again and moving back to the Karlsruhe area, he's a mechanical engineer. This is something that his son would be a mechanical engineer, Eugene Schwab, or Eugene, because it's without the E on the end. So it's like short for eugenics, maybe. I don't know. but Eugene Schwab's would tell Klaus Schwab and Ernst Rainer Schwab to become mechanical engineers if you want to make something of your life. And he would also tell Klaus that he had to go to Harvard.
You could argue that at that time in technological advancement that being a mechanical engineer was, in fact, the, you know, leading point you should be at. So it kind of sets that tone where it's like, okay, if we really want to change the direction, you need to, you know, arguably you could say that at this point in time, it would have been, you know, I don't know, what would be the perfect thing today? Something in regard to immunology, virology, or nanotechnology, right?
Yeah. Yeah, most definitely. I think we're looking at the Industrial Revolution, you can say, first started bubbling in 1820, going on 1850. By the time Gottfried Schwab is born, Germany is having a flourishing industrial revolution, so machines are almost everywhere. By the time he's 23, he's a baker. I know people would think, oh, that's probably not anything to do with machines. They probably was a baker on a wide scale, and they probably used old archaic type of machines to do that job to help with that process. And eventually becoming a machine engineer is like, well, I mean, if you want to become a computer programmer now, then that's what you want to get into, actually get a job and get some money. And it's the same back then for mechanical engineer. Same back for things like gas fitting and stuff. Gas fitters were really common back in the late 1800s. And loads of people were trained on that because it was the introduction of these new technologies and the Industrial Revolution was like in two stages. The first and second were in the 1800s, really. Right. And the mechanization would, of course, lead to war. So Gottfried eventually decided to go back to Germany and settle back there was probably because he picked up his qualifications. And I couldn't find evidence of his qualifications, but I would assume that he went to ETH Zurich, which seemed to be a family pattern afterwards, which is a mechanical engineering college that has been around for some time.
So bringing this to in regard to the company specifically, because there's a lot of history there that is very relevant to this discussion, but bringing it to the idea of Eicher Weiss, I believe is how it's pronounced, the company that ultimately is the kind of focal point of the family and how it changed hands and ultimately ended up being the key to the collaboration with the Nazi party and technology. So what was it about that caught your eye and how did you find that information and, you know, touch on that and how it began with the family and going forward?
Yeah, well, when I started looking into Eicher Weiss had a long history, set up in 1805. The Ravensburg Germany branch was 1860. It was set up by a guy called Walter Zuppinger. It started off doing like lace manufacturing, peculiar systems for wrapping lace. But by the early 1900s, it was doing turbines and large machinery for hydroelectric dams and things like that as this new technology was coming in. They had expanded, and of course they were also fitting ships, etc. But they had a rocky time. Everybody had a rocky time after World War One. Obviously, sales dropped off a bit, and in the 1920s, you had Escher Weiss having money troubles in the early 20s, and then again in the early 30s, where they would have to be fully restructured, and a group would be set up, headed by the Swiss Federal Bank, to reorganize the structure of this company, coming up especially to war. Now, the restructuring happened in the 30s. So from the Great Depression, there was obviously, that was way too much for Escher Weiss to handle financially. And so they had to restructure their entire organization. And that meant lots of outsiders come in. By 1939, one of their engineers, a Colonel Jacob Schmidheiny, who was a Swiss colonel, would become the board of directors of Escher Weiss. And Eugene Schwab, Klaus Schwab's father, had been working at Escher Weiss as a director, the factory managing director, so the big boss in the Ravensburg branch, which is famous for making some of the newest technology that would come up. In the future, it would do the same as well. I mean, it never stopped being a pioneer in certain technologies that would eventually be useful for war. So the Escher Weiss factory in Ravensburg was the biggest employer in the Ravensburg area. And Eugene Schwab, in that case, was the biggest manager. They would, through the 1930s, have that restructuring. But by the time that war hit, they made it very clear that don't worry about us not making money during the war. On the contrary, we're a neutral country. We can probably make a lot of money. You know, we're going to
be fine. Right, right. There's a quote in the article about that. I remember basically saying that this, you know, insinuating that that's going to be something that will happen, which later does happen. One thing I wanted that I thought was very interesting in the article is the discussion of this is before the 1930s, that it was, as you pointed out, Klaus Schwab's father, who was the employer of the company in Ravensburg. And you point out that Hitler's own party, the Nazi party, awarded the company the title of the National Socialist Model Company, which is just interesting that there's clearly right there a tie. But then you go on to point out, which I found really telling, and maybe you could tell me if maybe there was more to this that you didn't write about, but you talk about the discussion of how Ravensburg was an anomaly in the wartime in Germany, and it wasn't touched by Allied airstrikes. And it says a rumored agreement. Then the Allied forces publicly agree not to target that town. So what is there something there? I mean, because to me, that's right out of the gate. They made a deal with the Nazis to not be targeted or something like that. So what was going on there?
Well, personally, I think the dynamic was much more complicated than people probably think first off. Ravensburg, it was a very old region. But when the war started, the Swiss Red Cross went into there, and along with factories, leaders around the Red Cross, where it was rumored, and I found this in multiple places, but I couldn't find the actual concrete evidence from him speaking from the Red Cross. But Eugen Schwab was apparently involved in the Red Cross, and there was a agreement with the Allies that this wasn't a place of strategic importance during the war, and it shouldn't be bombed. And they didn't. They didn't target all throughout the war. And I think there was something much more to that, because they were building instruments that would go into the Norsk, Røyken, a Norwegian heavy water plant that the Nazis were using to produce their atomic bomb, to attempt to produce their atomic bomb. They were supplying all of the pieces up there. So I think that the Allies would have wanted them to develop their nuclear program, atomic program to an extent so that they could find out if they have any breakthroughs and they can basically steal some of that information. Because I think the Norwegian plant was really protected, but there was constant Norwegian resistance raids. There was commander raids by the British and the Norwegians. Eventually, they would sink a boat that was trying to take heavy water back to Germany to produce the bomb. So that was like, that's been covered over and over again in films and documentaries. This place was a very important place, but I feel that it would have been a leaky place intelligence wise, because you would have had lots of Norwegians around and other people who weren't really on the Nazi sides, but were really, really good at not getting killed and making it look like they were on the Nazi side, you know? The type of people you can kind of like, you can kind of understand why they're there, but some of those I think would have probably leaked out intelligence. So the British had obviously masses of intelligence. The Norwegian resistance had masses of intelligence. The fact they not hit in Ravensburg while Ravensburg's producing things for this plant makes me think that there was a want to have that intelligence, but also to set down like a safe zone. It could be argued that the Ravensburg factory could hide behind the fact that it was a Swiss factory, even though it's producing armaments. And I found on the record group, so RG226, I think it's called, which is the record group for the National Office of War Statistics, etc. That record group, I found a couple of mentions to Esler Weiss selling things to the Nazis during that time, like flamethrowers and shipping it under separate companies. It was also like a lot of Nazi stuff that was being held that was just being seen as export stuff that was being held in Switzerland to be transferred, and the Americans and the Allies knew all of this information, so they were getting some information from somewhere. But where, of course, this is a time of true espionage in that region, and Switzerland as well. You have to remember who was in Switzerland on the American Allied front in 1932, doing his espionage out of a house in Bern, and basically openly having all people who are obviously connected. All the Germans were doing the same in Switzerland as well, but Alan Dulles was there in Switzerland. So Switzerland was a really important place for all of the actions that went on in Germany, because it allowed German and the Allies to all kind of mix together.
Well, what's interesting there is, so that makes a lot of sense. And I actually didn't even think about that. Obviously, this, you know, my mind goes in more, you know, call me a conspiracy theorist, right? But it's interesting that that in and of itself is, it shows you that they potentially were, you know, trying to watch up until a point they could sabotage or take information they could benefit themselves. But it also may suggest the possibility of more collaboration, because there's a lot of interesting information around the history here that suggests that there was a lot more going on between the United States government and the Nazi Party, you know, or the families funding the Nazi Party, you know, so that might be something more there as well. But it's just an interesting thing to think about, because it goes on. You point out that they went forward, that working to produce weapons and German fighter plane parts. And then you also point out that the Western military intelligence were aware of the capacity and the collaboration. So that is interesting. Like, it could go either way, but that seems to much more to me to suggest that there's more collaboration than waiting to see when they can take something, you know, because that seems a little bit dangerous, to put it lightly.
And I think in these circles, collaboration is like they all know they're on separate teams, and there's like this fun competition between them to see who can steal the other people's research. Mm-hmm. And that's like, you know, that turns into a collaboration, because both sides know what they're doing. In the same sense, there's the race to this sort of technology was always going to be a this period of history, and over the next 20 years, 30 years of history after the war, would always be the big race, the big arms race. I got a feeling maybe deep down, that's why the knowledge that this technology was right on the horizon is why World War II probably happened in the first place. I have that feeling.
That's an interesting thought.
That they like coalesced into, okay, we're hitting an arms race, but such a big arms race, it could change the entire world. So now this is a proper race for it. So
interesting connection to today as well. And the fact that they would know these things are coming and the people weren't informed, and war is created as a pretext to I mean, that's it's just exactly what we're seeing today in so many obvious ways.
Distracting the masses and an ability for them to legally cull certain members of humanity.
Yeah. Yes.
Remember, the wars back then, they were devastating wars. They were just like sending people across a no man's land to be cut up at times. Like, you know, World War II got a little bit better than World War I, of course, in the way that they targeted each other. But still, it was just, I mean, wreaked havoc all the way across Europe, except for Switzerland, who made a bomb before and made a bomb after in all sorts of senses. Because,
on that point about the Swiss, though, this is another thing that really sticks out to me, is that you point out as well that the Swiss were, as you, and you mentioned a minute ago, allowing German exports to other countries, and which is, again, as you pointed out, a supposedly neutral area. Yeah. So why all the way to today is it still considered, even like the joke, you know, the Swiss, they're neutral. It's like, so we know the history, and yet that's still the perception. That seems to, again, suggest to me that there's more going on there. You know, like, not just that they were trying to take, like, if it was only about stealing data information for their own uses, and they were still fighting this side, you know, by and large, today we would be able to look back and be like, well, yeah, the Swiss were actually working with the Germans, or at least in part, in some people in the location, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Just another point.
Well, you have to see as well that where Germany came from. Germany came from this, like in the 1800s, this collection of republics and states and et cetera that merged into this empire and then got split up after World War One, like violently, and then got like the of course, German speaking communities were now spread in all different countries, and that was always going to be a recipe for disaster. A lot of this, a lot of what happened during the war seemed to be more distraction for what's really going on behind the scenes, because I think what was really going on behind the scenes is what's always going on behind the scenes. I mean, a small group of people trying to maintain the most control they possibly can. The Germans were really good at this. They persecuted a lot of people through that time. And I think eventually that's why their whole house of cards came tumbling down. Because if Eugene Schwab and the Ravensburg factory and Escher Weiss and all of those people who helped had managed to produce the first atomic bomb for the Germans, that would have been a game changer. That would have been Britain. I personally believe that would have been Britain. Same way we saw Japan as a test over on the other side, they drop it on a couple of, they would prove their might in a big way. So it was really dangerous times as well.
Well, one of the other parts as well that indicate clearly that it wasn't just about technology, or rather that at the very least they were willing to allow atrocities to take place while doing this, is that the factory employed 198 and 203 civil workers and POWs during the war, as you point out in the article. Mm-hmm. A special camp for forced laborers. Like, this is a time when this I mean, that in and of itself, I don't understand why that topic is not gigantic. It's in regard to the Swiss discussion, in regard to this family. I mean, would you call them concentration camps in the context of what was happening out there? I mean, it's the same thing.
Yeah. There was pretty bad. I mean, the forced labor camps were awful. And the Russians who went there were treated extremely badly by all reports.
This was one of the largest Nazi forced camps, you say, right? I mean, that's talked about.
All of the reports I saw was them saying it was the largest. It was the largest out of all of them. But I had to contextualize that with the fact that I couldn't find the evidence, the statistical evidence to prove that. So I have to say one of the largest, because I believe it was the largest camp. That was because it was such a good area. They knew they weren't going to, they could get really good productivity when they knew they weren't going to get bombed. And it's a really complicated area as well, because a lot of people in that area didn't necessarily consider themselves fully German. They were mostly German, with a little bit of Swiss in there too, and the people on the other side of the Swiss border were mostly Swiss with a little bit of German too. The both regions speak different dialects to the surrounding areas, so in a sense this whole area of southern Germany and Switzerland in general has always been like this little area that's worked together. So it's not a surprise to see how they cooperated, and I think it's the impulse of the Swiss government wanting to make make money from armaments, and they've obviously got a stake within the Escher Weiss company at this time as well. So, I mean, this goes back to, remember, the Federal Bank of Switzerland were involved in the takeover. So they know what's going on down here. They know what the camp's doing. They know how many people are working in there, and they know how productive it's being. And I did come across some evidence, but I couldn't again find like concrete evidence that there was a sub camp for Dachau in Ravensburg. So there was a camp that like Jewish people who were being shipped through to be sent to Dachau, or gypsies or Jehovah's or whoever were being persecuted at the time. They would be shipped towards Dachau. They would go and spend time in a sub camp. But I couldn't find any of the sub camps mapped out, because when the Nuremberg trial happened, there was this like, and I said this yesterday on a show, it's really important to mention, there was a great reset. There was a moment in when it was 0 hour in Germany, where they worked out they were the bad ones in this narrative, in the story, for what they'd done, for what they had agreed to, and that they were the ones who were wrong, and that we should reset and work along reconciliation rather than holding some of the most worst butchers to account. Instead, those butchers were whipped up through Operation Paperclip and stuff,
right,
and
right,
over to the Americas. So there's this like big moment of, and I don't think people really understand that was a really great reset. That was organized all throughout the war, how it was going to be afterwards, and it was mapped out. And then when it took place, it was everybody's accountability out the window. We'll hang how many people did they hang? It's much less than 100. I think it was like something like 15 people or something of the top brass, but most of them got off with a little slap on the wrist and moved to Argentina or somewhere
right along those lines. Which is an open secret now, talked about on History Channel, and we act like that's still quasi conspiracy theory. It's just the way that works.
Yeah, there's definitely, I would say there's definitely a Swiss involvement within all of the war, mainly upon the Nazis, as a side of the Hitler's Germany and the Nazis. I would say that for sure, to just round that off.
That's very revealing again, and why that's not discussed is quite revealing to me in general. But so this brings us into this idea. Oh, I wanted to point out before I forget, talking about, I always point this out as well, because it seems to get left out of that discussion, is likewise from Japan. Dr. Ishii, but that became the basis for the U.S. government bio manipulation security, you know, the working with these bio, components and making weapons and using it to experiment. That's where that came from. Dr. Ishii was doing some of the most disconcert. I'm trying to think of the worst word for it. Like, you know, opening human bodies, doing horrible things to people while they're alive. And then we're just like, yeah, come on over, we'll use you too. You know, and it's really disgusting how that tends to work throughout history. But getting into the Great Reset point there, which was really interesting, this is, where do you see, walk us through the correlation here with the agenda mindset back then and how the thread continues to today, right? Because we're seeing this mindset of the Great Reset and what they're trying to accomplish then, such as being a mechanical engineer and trying to reshape the way we're going, right? So at the time when they're working with this company and what they're doing, you know, what's the morals and the agenda they had then that's leading them into the Great Reset of today?
So, you had that moment where everything changed in Germany. You've got to remember, Klaus Schwab's a young boy. Lots of people wanted him to be Hitler Youth or something. But he would have been like, 1 year old when the war started and 6 years old when even if you were dressed up as a Nazi at 6 years old, I wouldn't blame that on you. I think that would probably be your parents. But afterwards, there was a big, especially within this area where you have the borders of places like France, Germany, and the newly returned Austria. You've got a big period during the war where lots of groups were trying to change the mind of other groups. So Klaus Schwab, when he was young, was someone who was headed up a group that was to convince French children that German children weren't so bad. that the Germans weren't so bad because culturally they had just destroyed their country and etc. And their parents all hated them, and they were all worried that something would one day start again, because that's two times in a row. You've got to be a bit like suspicious after that. So you had people like that, and organizations headed by people like a young Klaus Schwab, who were trying to basically present like this ideology of, oh no, we're a very nice bunch of people and we're not a nasty bunch. Now, it's true, they're probably all very much a nice bunch of people, but what you find is that's a root in Klaus Schwab's history, his ability to try and convince people that everything's okay, that everything's all right. Don't worry about the people over there. I know they attacked you before, but everything's fine. We're going on to a new era.
And I would add right there, the simultaneous point in that, which we're seeing thread all the way to today, is that all of these changes as well will be good for everybody, right? And I thought a really interesting point that stood out for me in your article was the discussion of, if I'm saying it correctly, the Splugen Railway Tunnel, and how he discusses this, and his father, Eugene Schwab, discussed this, and he says, quote, that this project will create new opportunities in cultural, economic, and social development. And I was like, well, that's right out of today. You know, it's interesting. All the way back then, they're talking about a railway tunnel, but it's the same premise.
And it's same just, rhetoric.
Yes.
Completely.
Development. Go ahead.
Well, the thing is about that, which I found really interesting, that was like basically be echoed by Klaus in many different occasions afterwards in the way he spoke about things. Because when he started speaking out, he is speaking in the press, Klaus Schwab, when eventually he did something, he wouldn't be as, he would be seem more robotic. He would talk about human capital and things like that. Mm-hmm. But his father, I think, swayed his mind swayed his way of being to present yourself well, whatever else is going on behind the scenes.
Right.
So his father back then, when he's at the Splugen Railway, is like the head of the Chambers of Commons, the president of the Chambers of Commons for the Ravensburg area. So where he's tried to get Swiss citizenship back in 1950 and run away from Germany, now he's back in politics because people like von Papen and Eugen Schwab and other people who failed the German people massively during the run-up to the war politically, those people went straight back into politics after the war. It was just a change what they say out loud. It wasn't a change of ideology. So there was also something that's really pertinent to what you were saying. This is there's lots of groups and associations that are being built up from very early on in these areas. I'm talking like back to the Ravensburg trade committees back in the Middle Ages, all the way up. There's always these organizations that are tackling this. And I think it's from being on the borderlands, tackling this issue of trying to keep people peaceful in some way, shape or form, and trying to maintain control in an area that was racked by war for many years. So I get a feeling that it's like something that's been handed down, a culture that's been handed down from the many years of Prussian wars and things like that. Mm-hmm. In this area, they had to reconcile all of the time, and so and they had to just like, oh, war's over, so now we're all back to normal again. And that sort of that frame of mind comes up a lot in this, because they just get on with it after the war. There's lots of little groups that come up that will eventually lead to the World Economic Forum.
This was a time of exactly like you're talking about. This was the first Great Reset, right? This is a time after the war where they had a fresh, thick, a clean slate, right? Whole cloth. Yep. They could do what they wanted. And that's exactly where these people want. That's what they're trying to create today, it would seem. And I found it interesting just the connection to someone like Henry Kissinger. As you point out, he's one of his most influential people in his life. That's very alarming to realize talking about their connections, you know?
The amazing thing about Klaus Schwab is his amount of qualifications. It's extremely impressive, daunting, some would say. He's got like, I don't know, something like 12 degrees or some stuff like that. And when he was getting degrees, they were like basically being given to him after the first couple. He was like, he didn't have to study that hard. He didn't have to go to a university for a few years to learn stuff. He would be given degrees by different places. It was like,
sounds like what Bill Gates is getting today, right?
Yeah. So I think they were building him up to be something. Who they are, I'm not quite sure, but he was being noticed. And his father really was insistent on him going to Harvard if he was going to be a great person. Who teaches him at Harvard? No one else but Henry Kissinger. I mean, that is amazing. And later on, you can say that I think it was the one of the deans at Harvard or something along those lines gave him the idea to do a European management symposium. He put that in his mind. The creation of the World Economic Forum was an idea from Harvard. And the spirit of Davos was really the spirit of Harvard, as someone else pointed out in their very good article about Klaus Schwab, sterile but good article about Klaus Schwab. There was this period in history where the Americans were trying to make sure they were on the front of technological revolutions. And Henry Kissinger and people like that were on the forefront of making sure that that happened. That's why Henry Kissinger is probably going to be the first person to be uploaded into the cloud eventually. Yeah. He's been after it for a long time. It's really intriguing that just after that period, he gets taught by Kissinger in 66. He goes out in 67 and he gets a job for Schulze, Escher Weiss, who have just joined forces. Schulze is going around at this point. It's another company that did bad things with the Nazis during the war and were scorned by the Allies afterwards. So they always were, they had a hard time breaking into American and Western markets after World War II. And I think they were looking to brighten up their name a bit by adding changing it a little bit. But they
with another Nazi collaborator, of course, because that's the perfect way to.
Yeah. Which one's worse? Oh, I suppose one of them's better. That makes it, you know, you see the old fallacies are the best fallacies. But with that, it was like they bought 53, the Schulze brothers come in and bought 50, another Swiss company, mechanical engineering company, bought 53% of Escher Weiss, so took it over. And over between 1967 and 1970, Klaus Schwab would be the one heading up the actual reorganization. He would be brought in as assistant to the president and director of Schulze, Escher Weiss, and he would help reform the company from a mechanical engineering firm into a technological corporation.
Right. And this is where I find it to be very telling as well to what he's doing today, as he transformed it into a company that's really talking about, as you discussed, medical technology products to form the basis for that discussion. And that's just a really interesting tie into where we are today, all the way back then. Right. So it's like the forethought to be able to look forward into, I mean, this speaks to not that they're able to see where the direction is going, but that they're shaping the direction. That's what that feels like to me.
Well, I think a lot of what I've discovered from my investigations of various people who do this sort of stuff is the idea of like evangelism, technological evangelism, finding the things that will be the next things that aren't made yet, and finding the people to make them, create them, prototype them, patent them, make a lot of money off them, but also control the power that thing has in the way that you want to control it. So these technological evangelists, has never been so many around than there are today. They're people who are literally trying to make the technology that maybe should even be made. And that was something that is very much within Escher Weiss. Escher Weiss's history is making the technology that probably shouldn't be made, but for the people who you probably shouldn't make it for. Like, and this is where we enter into Klaus Schwab and South Africa, because I mean, it's
another part of the story that is just baffling that's not being discussed right now. Yeah. I mean, that is incredible, especially with the discussion. I mean, as it's becoming more allowable to discuss, I guess, in the mainstream circles of apartheid Israel, right? I mean, it's just amazing that that's being ignored. So what was that? Was that something that you saw on this research beforehand? Or was that something that you kind of like fell into while you were researching it and were just like, oh man, that's another side of this?
Well, there's a road. When you start researching anybody, like the first thing you do is like a day of like brainstorming or a night of brainstorming. And we did that with this. As Whitney let me get on with the research after the initial bit, but she was such a great resource at the beginning, because we had like a good day where we just went through all of the information that we could find out there. And the links to South Africa and making the bomb with Escher Weiss came up very early on. So it was like, that's going to be interesting to get to and research when I finally get there. But for the first part, I kind of had to go right back to the beginning and spend the first part of it just really mapping out where we were heading towards. So I was more surprised, because it went that way, I was more surprised that I found that Escher Weisse and Klaus Schwab's father were doing exactly the same thing during World War II, which is helping South Africa produce heavy water uranium for their nuclear projects. At first, that was like 1967, that stopped, where you've got this takeover, Schulze, Escher Weisse aren't only just working, Schulze aren't only working with Escher Weisse, they're already putting a group together of other like electrical engineering companies and other engineering companies and factories in the area to organize how they do business. And it seems like this restructuring to define who's allowed to make what, so that all parts can be compartmentalized or whatever. They can be put into little boxes, and each person in each of these areas don't know what the other one's up to. You know, I think that was the restructuring of 1967, what it seemed like. South Africa dropped his heavy water projects to make uranium enrichment from heavy water with the help of Escher Weisse, and instead they went on to what was going to be their successful nuclear arms race, which started just around that time where Klaus Schwab's just up there, and they already were producing nuclear technology for nuclear reactors and stuff. They were in procurement meetings with government organizations, Escher Weisse, this is Schulze Escher Weisse. And then later on, when a report came out by a guy called Peter Hug and the Swiss federal government were forced to look into it, they discovered Schulze Escher Weisse had been building the parts for the nuclear project that would eventually be the sanctioned and embargoed nuclear project. They weren't allowed. What's the term for it? A UN. My words have gone.
Sorry, I would jump in if I knew. I'm just not sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, basically, there was the rule that said South Africa couldn't make weapons of mass destructions in the 70s, and Schulze Escher Weisse was still supplying them with weapons of mass destruction. So right. Klaus Schwab's reset of Schulze Escher Weisse, that reset was one which led to South Africa gaining nuclear weapons illegally during against international law, and it's quite astounding that he would be sitting in the same place in the same company that his father was like 20, 30 years before, doing exactly the same thing.
And it's the idea not only that they were aiding an apartheid regime that was doing horrible atrocities to you know, committing human rights violations and so on, which is obviously very relevant to the sanctimonious push they're driving today, but it's also the idea that they are driving this idea about non-proliferation and nuclear weapons, where he has a history of doing exactly that. But on top of all of that, the one that really stands out to me more than anything is going forward to 1970 and recognizing that they're doing this during a time when it's illegal under U.S. law, the non-proliferation or international law, non-proliferation treaty. So
the word I was looking for was UN resolution. UN resolution that stopped forbade South Africa creating nuclear weapons.
Right. So which they're violating that. But on top of it, the idea that the U.S. government can continue to work with this company or the person today, knowing that they violated this, it's just ridiculous. It shows you that they pick and choose how they apply the laws and things that they enforce. You know, it's very clear that these are at least dishonest businessmen willing to do whatever they can to get ahead, even if it hurts people.
The reason why we're able to know so much about it now is that at the time, clandestine projects are really hard to get your finger on. And even now, I mean, it's hard to research this stuff to actually find information. But this turned out to be actually one thing that should have been picked up by some journalist somewhere. The fact that there was a whole report out from the Swiss federal government showing how South Africa gained their nuclear weapons, and how it was Swiss who helped them do it, and Escher Weiss Schulze AG eventually, because once Klaus Schwab's reformation of Schulze Escher Weiss happened, it became just Schulze AG again. So they were able to let go of the Escher Weiss name eventually, but it was the same company. And still today, Schulze, if you look at their timeline, will say, oh, our Escher Weiss branch would do this and our Escher Weiss branch would do that. So they still consider themselves, they just rebranded. There's a lot of this rebranding, resetting. So you don't get any criminal prosecutions for the criminality you've been involved in before. This is really what it is. And I think that angle is something that of the Great Reset that we really should be thinking about. I think there's a lot of criminality that's gone on in the world. And once AI goes online, like their AI, they're going to bust themselves, because their system is going to be easily pulled apart by extreme intelligence, that they've this godlike intelligence that they want to create. If that's so, if that is true, that it can be easily picked apart, then they're going to be the first ones who are going to be noted by as breaking the law in the past.
Well, I guess that depends on who's controlling the direction or inputting the information, the drives that they're using.
It's why resets are so important. It's right. Why resets, and the reset is really, if we look at it, a way to stop from any accountability taking place.
Right. Well, here's a small microcosm of that. I mean, look at things they do in Syria, just simply changing the names of groups that they arm that are the terrorist organizations. When they get caught, they just change their name. You know, it comes higher, Tir al-Sham. It's all ultimately terrorist al-Qaeda groups that, you know, and this is the same kind of thing that we're talking about today. And the reimagining, rebranding, all these same words that we're hearing across this whole concept. And it's just about, as you're saying, hiding the things that they've done or hoping that you don't have the wherewithal to trail it back between their shifting of their names. But go ahead.
I was just going to say that I mean, they've made that possible by buying up all of the news agencies so that right. No one does any investigative journalism anymore. They do the most simple stuff, or they try and target certain individuals, because a lot of the reports that happen, people who are against the establishment in some way, shape or form have enemies high up, and so they'll do hit pieces on them. So that's most of the investigative journalism that really takes place, not the actual what happened before, because God, as humans, we need to know what happened before to do things right the next time. It's why I'm really frustrated when people don't tell their children when they grow up about the harder things that happen to them in life. Because these are the things that mean your children get on better, because they have your experience as well as their own experience.
You learn from your mistakes. You learn more from mistakes than you do from successes. Absolutely.
Yeah. And there's so much shame attached in talking about the past with most people. And I think that that's really an element, psychological human element of this, is that people want to hide what they've done because they want to go on with the future. And in a sense, that's mostly fair. But and you can change change your ways. I mean, a small amount of people can change their ways completely and become a good person. But when you've done loads of bad things over and over again, and it's built up and the evidence is there, well, it looks dodgy for you.
There's a big difference between accountability and, like, you know, yes, someone can change their mind. Somebody could adapt their opinions and, you know, but if you've committed crimes, just because you change your mind doesn't make those no longer crimes. You know, it's very clear, as I'm sure you're saying, you know, it right now we can see that all they're trying to do is hide their past actions. And maybe if they were doing things, you know, turning a new leaf, that maybe we could argue something different. But clearly, in my opinion, is that they're not. They're hiding these things and then going forward to start anew and commit the same atrocities. Yeah. You know, to me, it starts to paint this picture of allowing, I mean, because what I'm bringing us into the discussion of the depopulation idea, you know, which seems to be very prominent in this whole thing, is that creating situations where that, you know, war or the use of nuclear weapons that could end up achieving that goal to a certain degree, you know, and committing these crimes and having the governments involved with them act like they're not happening, you know, all the way into, you know, the late 80s, continuing to work with these groups and making illegal nuclear technology, you know, and it makes you wonder whether the whole point was to depopulate. Which, you know, we can talk about the Club of Rome next and how this is something that aligns very clearly with the World Economic Forum. You know, so do you feel that that's a primary thing that's happening today? And, you know, what are your thoughts on
that? We've got a problem with every part of society today. There's not something that isn't going to be difficult to deal with. I lost my train of thought. I was thinking something and then I lost it. So can you repeat your just last question?
Sorry. I can rattle off like 30 questions.
No, it just made me think about three other things and I got distracted. Go on. Sorry.
No, it's really interesting to see the evolution of this and you can, the depopulation is something that, this ties back to the eugenics discussion, which, you know, Whitney's talked about a lot. You've talked about a lot. I've talked about recently quite a bit in regard to how it seems even today, right now, these efforts, whether accidentally or not, which I just don't believe that's the case, are going in that direction. They're removing the weakest of society. So tying this in with the Club of Rome and the connections, the similarities between the World Economic Forum and the Club of Rome and how Klaus Schwab is connected to both, you know, and the question ultimately was about depopulation and whether their actions all the way back then to today are, you know, aimed at that in some degree.
I this is why there's so many things I can say. That's why I partially got distracted, because I think people, humans, have this weird, the ones who are unable to create, the ones who are unable to feel that emotional spark with other people, tend to head towards places of power. And then once they get into power, they tend to commit acts that are psychological projections of the terrors that they've faced in life that they don't want to discuss with anybody because they have to remain looking powerful. So I think there's a whole human psychology here where there seems to be two things that powerful humans who can create want to do, and that's destroy, and that means human life. That's been seen over and over again. If we look at how World War I started, where the new machine gun technology came in and they were just marching people into machine gun fire and they were just dying for days and days and weeks, just marching into Belgian fortresses, German army people just marching forward with like just being told to do so. They're getting rid of people. That's just sending people to the slaughter. And we've seen it over and over again where people in history would be sent to the slaughter. But I think humans have a couple of different things that they like to do when they get into power and they're not creative, which is to destroy other humans and brutalize children. It seems to be a running theme. Mutilation seems to be a running theme. Terror seems to be a running theme. These people, they want to let you know who's in control and let you know how powerful they are.
I would say a running theme lead with the technocrats, right? Yeah. Like, you mean like the whole entire human race, right? With this entity.
We're heading towards a genocide now. We're heading towards multiple genocides on multiple fronts. Well, and in a sense, what's going on now is a form of genocide.
I would argue, though, that by and large, and maybe this is just my wishful thinking, you know, that humanity, our society, our species wants good things, and we want to be inherently good people, or at least that's how they perceive us. Because if they didn't think that, Caitlin Johnstone makes this point often, and I agree with this, that if we didn't want to be better and, you know, fight for good things and freedom and liberty, they wouldn't pretend to be that. You know what I mean? So it's clearly being driven at us to say, look, we're this good thing when they're really not. So I personally, at least maybe hope that our you know, humanity is inherently good to a large degree, you know, at least wanting to be.
But they want to destroy that.
Exactly.
So the whole idea at the time, if you're thinking about people they're looking to for answers at the time of things like the outbreaks of the big wars in the past, a lot of these people were saying things that you cannot say out loud at all nowadays because, well, number one, someone will educate you on why you're a F-tard. And also because it's just like, we'll destroy your career and you won't be able to do anything. So these people now hide in the shadows. But really, there was a lot of, if you look at the flourishing of things like Orwell and Huxley and stories of dystopia around this time, people knew we were heading towards a technological revolution. They knew there was something big coming. They knew the age of the atom was going to be big. And lots of the people in power at those times thought it was going to happen soon. thought they were going to be able to get to a stage where they're completely in power and completely above everybody else very soon, that they will get into maybe even a transhumanist, a more perfect state of human than all of these rest of the people. This idea of superiority has always been there at the time. And I think they thought at the beginning that this was going to come much quicker, but it's actually come really slowly. And now you see the race again for people being excited about the destruction of humanity as a whole, literally saying that in 100 years we won't be humans because we would have put technology in ourselves so much that we will be more robots and cyborgs. So what this whole agenda is leading towards is the extinction of the human race and replacing it with something that they think from fantasies in the past will suit them better and make them more powerful and able to wield that power more successfully.
It's just the technological advancement of the eugenics mentality, right? I mean, like you're taking eugenics and you bring it into the technological age, and maybe even it seems like they believe, because eugenics historically is more about like eliminating the negative parts of our society or our species. But in this case, it almost seems like they think that they can rework, you know, change these people to be better, you know, with using this technology.
Yeah, you know, eugenics is a really hard one, because when you talk about it, because the parts aren't, the course is, it doesn't never comes to the right conclusion. Eugenicists never come to the right conclusion. The conclusion they go through is that some humans are bred, maybe you could say it that way, better than other humans. Some humans have a better immune system and a bigger mind and a better capacity to learn. And some humans have a better ability to run and be fast and all of these things. If you keep working along those lines, you come to a conclusion that everybody can't be what they're not, and that human beings are really fantastic for something that's come from nature. What their plans are is something like, or what they, how they see it running off is that if people are inferior, they should be killed. And that's the difference between someone who can look at genes and accept that genes do have an effect, a scientific and biological effect on who you are, how you act, how you react, how you manifest your behavior and manifest yourself physically. All these genes that you've had from before are all very important, and they all give you little things that are from previous generations. But that doesn't mean we have to kill everybody who is weaker than somebody else to keep them out of the gene pool. That is where they come to. They come to a point always, it's murderous. It's about destruction. It's not about creation. It's not about the fact that life. I've worked with autistic kids. I've worked with kids with Down syndrome, and you honestly, man, best humans alive. That you strip away all of the bits that you don't like about humanity, you get someone who's autistic or who's got Down syndrome, because they're completely of innocence. They do not do anything to harm you or anything to hurt you. You keep building up the intelligence of humans, and what you've got is murderous people who want more power. So I prefer the fact that people are able to be all different types. If there weren't autistic people in the world, and there's a lot of them now, which is really worrying and also suspicious, seeing as they pumped in so many different types of chemicals and things to the whole world, and the rates have been going up like exponentially since the first point of actually diagnosing autism. If there weren't disabilities though in the world and other things, we wouldn't see that sort of beauty. We wouldn't see all of the things. And I know life's hard for some people, and that's really sad. Maybe one day we can find the medicines in a safe and proper way to help people who have got difficulties in their life, but not to create superhumans that are going to destroy the human race. And this just seems like such a simple thing for people like me and you. But these people have been on this agenda for a long time, because since eugenics has first come up, if you believe in eugenics, you either go one way or the other. You either say life is beautiful, really wide range, and it's really amazing how, you know, ancestors work. And maybe there could be something that where you like work out what genes you have and what gene your best partner. Maybe you could have dating apps or something like that, and etc. And you could look for it yourself. But to assume that because people are weaker or inferior, superior in some way, physically, mentally, that gives you or someone else a right of power of life and death over that person. It's obscene to us, but it's normal to some of these people.
It is. You know, and this stems back to all the other things we're talking about in foreign policy. You know, these people in these powerful positions believe they have the right. Not that they were put in that position, but that they have the right to make decisions over our lives.
It's very much like monarchy. There's a lot that rings like monarchy about the whole way they feel about themselves and aristocrats in general. Mm-hmm. It's that divine power that you've been put there by God, and so you deserve to rule. Now, there was a man back in Britain called King Charles I who believed that, and he had his head chopped off, and it showed that he didn't have any divine power, and right. It was the start of a special revolution within British culture that would lead to really the annexation of Britain by the Dutch in the 1700s when Mary and William took over, and there was a coup and they were just allowed to walk in. And then since then we've been ruled by people from other countries and other places, and people who they're just a long line of Germans and Dutch people who think they're better than us in some way, shape or form, but have inbred so much to keep those special genes intact that they got hemophiliacs, and they've got really bad
these specific groupings you're talking about.
So if you follow down that route, if you follow down the route that they go, they go to a place which is inbred, really, mm-hmm. which ends up with real deformities mental deformities.
Right, and it's interesting, you know, almost as if. You know, they have this mentality that they need to preserve that bloodline because it's better, but it ends up giving them the opposite. You know, it just shows you that it's a foul, it's incorrect. But on a quick note, though, and I've been looking at this for a long time. It does seem that there's some interesting discussion about whether or not the idea of genetic, you know, that you can basically have some genetic markers that pass down through your family, that seems like some people are arguing that may actually be incorrect. You know, I don't know enough to speak on it, but I think that's interesting. And that's like the newest level of this that we're still grappling with. It's interesting.
One thing of why I enjoy doing this work is because it is astounding every time I go past through a history of a family, how many times a family repeat and manifest the same behaviors. And it's to an extreme degree. There was one lady who was a barrister named Barbara Hewson who died this year, passed away. She was a supporter of people like Rolf Harris and stuff, and old paedophiles who were famous and saying, oh, well, they only touched 13-year-old girls, like, inappropriately. So, you know, that's normal and things like that. And she was trying to get them to be accepted as normal for their outrageous behaviors. And when I went back through her history, nearly every single member of her history for 700 years or 500 years were contrarians. They were all doing the opposite thing than you should do at the time in the place they're at, to such extreme levels that it becomes silly. It's these genes do manifest. They do manifest, and they may not manifest the same in everybody. It may not be like you're lazy, so that your child will be lazy or something like that. You know, it doesn't manifest in those type of way. But there's certain parts of your nature that you do definitely get from your parents and from their parents and from their parents. And eugenics has spoiled the world of ancestry, where you can go through and discover about yourself and who you are. A lot of what our own creation is like, we have no, it's accidental creation. We don't know where we come from. Our parents have made the decision to mate one night, and boom, 9 months later we appear. So we don't have a lot of control over this sort of stuff. But when we go back and look backwards, we see the similarities that can help you grow in the same way. But I've seen it over and over again through genetic research that there's traits that will come out over and over. Same with Bill Gates' family.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's definitely something to consider, you know, the way that we can see that. I mean, there's, you know, correlation there. But bringing this into the idea of depopulation and the Club of Rome and the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset and where this is all going, it definitely seems to be a thread throughout all of this that they're keeping quiet ultimately today, despite maybe Bill Gates saying it publicly on a TED talk. But the idea that this is something clearly that it's in their mindset, you could argue, is something they think they're doing to save humanity. That's certainly something people would argue.
They're doing a great good for mankind. They're doing a great good for a common man in their belief. To an extent, if you go through their workings, it makes sense. And when you look around then, and everybody who you hang around with and everybody you associate with has the same feeling and view, because it supports their understanding of status within society, and what other people perceive you as and see you as, and gives you prestige. Those things seem correct. You can see why, how they can come to the conclusion, but these people have never lived in the real world. Right. They don't understand why people at the bottom are at the bottom, why people are heroin addicts or prostitutes out in the street. And if they actually went and investigated why they are, they discover that people like them took advantage of other people who took advantage of other people who eventually had some psychological problem where they took advantage of another person. And it all comes from the top and is trickled down. It's a lot of these people who don't live like with human nature inside them will treat other people subhuman, and that mentality will then leak out through society. So their mentality on top is causing us trouble all of the time. It is causing us issues. And it's a chase for status and ego.
Yeah, I mean, this is the foundational, this is what the eugenics mentality has, is that they, like we said, they have the right to manipulate us, and that they think that we're a detriment to where they're trying to go. And this is the idea of, you know, the Club of Rome being a group that is in the, or the basically associated with, what was it called? His symposium.
European Management Symposium.
Yes. And ultimately, you write about the discussion. They wrote multiple books, 72, The Limits to Growth, discuss specifically global overpopulation.
And they speak in 1973. He's one of the Club of Rome is one of the keynote speakers, one of the head eugenic. I mean, these guys are talking about the threat at this time. The threat to humanity is humans themselves.
Right.
They're stating that out loud. And this is the end of public eugenic statements.
Right. Well, this is what I mean. This was the point where it seems they transitioned this into what they're really driving today. The book in 1991, The First Global Revolution, I'll read the quote you cite here. It says, "In searching for a common enemy against whom we can unite, we came up with the idea," I love how that's framed, "the idea of pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill." Doesn't mean that you could argue that means they did it because they thought it was dangerous, or more so sounds like they just figured it would work for their agenda. Even talking about global warming back then. And it says, "All these dangers are caused by human intervention in natural processes, but it seems to suggest that we should stop what they're doing right now, intervening in natural processes," but that's obviously not what they ultimately did.
They see our lives and a lot of what we do as a petri dish, I think. They see us as a testing point for them to create. I mean, like, for instance, with if you want to become a cyborg or a bionic man, then you're going to get the first generation and the second generation equipment that's going to give you all sorts of diseases and be funky and not work properly, so that they can get the seventh generation down the line and have the perfect machinery that you can't afford anyway. I mean, they whatever way they play, these guys are always going to try and be on top. And when they're open and they talk openly, you can start to read between the lines. Like, I mean, Bill Gates, you hear him and he's like so frustrating, because you know that he's got that same idea that most of the problem is human population. He stated over and over again anyway.
He's frustrated to have to pander to the people that he thinks are lesser than, essentially.
Yeah, and it only leads to it's a really nice way of saying it's your fault for living and breathing, plebs, that we're in this state, and you're the problem, the overpopulation. If it was just people who were really clever, we wouldn't be in this situation. If it was people who were really rich and knew how to do things, and capitalism has let us see who are the best in society, because the best has risen to the top. That's their ideology behind it, at least, I think, where they believe that they have been it's been proven that they are the greatest. So they already know they're in the driving seat. They've been planning many things, and it only takes in a selection of Petri dishes that is the world, like a billion Petri dishes all around the place. There's lots of different experiments going on in each of those little sample places. So with the rise of scientific technocracy and the rise of science and technology anyway in general, you're going to see more smaller examples, I think, of like technology being researched in one place that will suddenly explode all over the world, but happen all over the place. And we're about to see this like great rise into technology that's going to mean it's going to be a lot of bad people who have a lot of very powerful instruments. There's going to be a lot of people who have the tools that we were keeping from very bad people, or we've assumed we were keeping from very bad people. But
putting an end to other bad people for our benefit. Yeah.
Right? They're making the tools in the first place and selling it to us. And we're like, we better keep this tool so the bad people won't get us.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's all you can do is laugh at this point. I mean, these are horrible things, but it's the reality is that it's what we're laughing about is how ridiculous it is that they're framing this in a way that it's such so obviously not what's actually happening. And you can see these people with their history of working with the most demonized concept in our history, working with and helping and arming. And yet today they act like they're the ones fighting against what seems to be the same kind of mentality, right? They're, oh, you're a Nazi. Trump's a Nazi. He's a fascist. And yet they're the ones. It just seems kind of.
I think they embrace the hypocrisy. I don't know what a better way to say it. They kind of like embrace the idea that they can get away with saying bad things, and most of it is a projection then. So most of the actions you see them take, most of the things you see them say is their own fears and their own hate, hatred always coming out. And that's why we've got a world that's controlled, a world controlled by psychos is going to be a world a lot like the world we got now. I don't know how to get around that, but if you start discussing that, then the eugenicists get involved and say, well, we can handle it. Yeah. We know a way around that. Or intelligence service comes along and say, well, let us use this platform that'll keep everybody in line. I mean, when I first came over to Chile, there was a guy in a taxi took us from the airport. Oh, man, it was roadblocks, military roadblocks all the way, and I was puking because I had traveled for 24 hours, so I was a bit worried about getting caught. Like, but the guy said that in Chile, people have to be kept under control because it's so naughty.
Wow. You know? Yeah,
I mean, the mentality of that is not just in Chile, it's around the place.
Right. And it seems to show its head in places like that, where, you know, it's usually these things are being tested elsewhere before they come to the main locations. But, you know, to wrap this up today in general, I just want your thoughts on a couple of things as we finish up here. And, you know, clearly as the point was that we can see this thread of the same agenda being repackaged and repurposed and giving a facelift, and it's something new. Meanwhile, they seem to be dry. It's always same with politics. Actions versus narrative, right? They're saying one thing and then they're saying something different, but you'll notice the actions, the agenda maintain the same focal point. And in this case,
I was going to say, I think telling of this was right at the start of the pandemic nonsense, the epidemic, what really it is, I don't know.
The COVID event.
Yeah. I know the sniffles. At the start of that period of time, one of the first things they did in Britain was put forward to do not resuscitate.
Right.
Order exactly. On nearly everywhere before it even taken effect, before we had people supposedly in the hospitals as COVID casualties, they instantly started putting down the do not resuscitate orders on nearly everybody who they felt they could get rid of. And I think that was a sign that their agenda was, we went too soon with that. We're going to have to pull it back a little bit and hide it, because, I mean, oh God, we didn't think about that. Their agenda always goes like that. They give you clues to what they're doing, but sometimes those clues are really obvious, and that was an obvious point.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, they're basically showing us with things just like this. And I talked about the do not resuscitate orders and showed you how even as of, I think, a week ago, they just announced again for people with with disabilities, with learning disabilities. So this has nothing to do with whether or not you're at risk from COVID-19. They're just coming out with this obvious eugenics-based narrative. And I don't know how it's possible that 60% of the deaths from COVID, they're telling us from England, are disabled people. I don't know how it's possible outside of something like that, whether through malfeasance, negligence, whatever. It's still amounting to the same end result. And I just find it really unnerving to see something like that, you know? And then as well, I'm sorry if you had comments on that, go ahead.
No, I said completely. I'm just...
Oh, okay. As well, your thoughts on this in general. And this is something that this comes to the technocratic angle of this. And this is a document from 2002 put forward by the National Science Foundation, it's the U.S. government. And openly to talking about, and they say in this document, direct quote, we will alter evolution in 20 years with nanotechnology. It's called Converging Technologies for Improving Human Performance. I did an entire discussion about this. YouTube sent it, both of them actually, and the clip, even though it's citing a US document. So this is what I think is the end game here for what's happening. The nanotechnology, they told us 20 years from now they would be using it. It's the combination of nano, bio, information, and cognitive. And this
that
is what
period of time.
Sorry, go ahead.
That period of time, the early noughties, as they call it, was such a fundamentally obvious time for workshops of this type to go up, because I think people were like, oh, the millennium, the new generation, all this new technology, let's start doing it now. And you can find lots of these sort of workshops and meetings, but this one is a really special one. I've seen some parts of this, because this says it straight out. This is just, I mean, balls out. This is what we're going to do, and this is what we're seeing now. So it's quite.
I brought it up at the point to say, you know, it's ultimately because I think at this time in 2002, we had real no. It's like talking about flying cars in the 50s. People are going like, well, okay, that's interesting, but that's like that's science fiction. No, people didn't take this to heart because it was way ahead of when this was and maybe it was a real. I mean, look, in 2004, I know I've seen someone discuss this and show documents of the smart dust. The size, a third the size of a grain of rice a grain of salt in 2004. God knows where it is right now, you know? So it's like, clearly they were on this, but go ahead.
Oh, well, no. This is their technology. We know their technology is generations ahead of our technology. Mm-hmm. So a couple of generations at least. So what they've been doing and what they've been seeing is this has been a revolutionary time in technological evangelicism. History. They get to go out and they get to really create new technology that'll be out in 2 years' time that doesn't exist at the moment. Something Klaus Schwab says at the end of the 60s about how a lot of the technologies that will be in the 70s won't even exist when he's talking, like just 4 years before he's saying. So there was elements where they saw this was going to run fast, but this really, like, the build up now is we're seeing the plans that were set down at the beginning of the millennium now be pushed through, and they like these things. They like, oh, let's start doing all of this stuff in the turn of the millennium and the new era, and it's nice and fresh. We've made a good breaking point, and we go on. It's gone so it goes as fast as the technology increases, and at the moment that's like exponentially. That's technology nearly always, if you look from the very first, from like plows and wheels all the way up, it basically goes up exponentially every year. Every next technology is like, it makes it so much better. So now we're at a state which is just beyond our understanding, and these guys are tinkering around with some things that are going to cause so many deaths.
Well, at the very least, we're talking about people that have had a proven history of a eugenics mindset, eugenics actions in real world settings, manipulating societies. And now these same people are involved with this new imagining. That, I mean, why that's not that's lost on people, I don't understand. But then we know the idea of the point we made earlier, the technological step in this eugenics, you know, mindset. And that's where we bring it into nanotechnology. And, and since I have this up, let me just play this really quickly because this is relevant.
What the fourth industrial revolution will lead to is a fusion of our physical, our digital, and our biological identities.
Right, so he's just straight up telling us, right? I mean, this is what we are doing. And they talked about this all the way back 20 years from now, we're going to alter evolution. So it just shows you that maybe they're doing things for good or in their mind, or maybe some people think they're doing that. But at the core level, This is the group that has been trying to do this, as your article points out, for a really long time. And so we need to ask the question, as we have nanotechnology in our vaccines now, or in the newer vaccines we're using, there's nanotechnology being applied in the actual administration of the vaccine now in regard to the patches. We have nanotechnology being applied in regard to fighting climate change. I mean, it's all over the place, right? And it's alarming that it's not being discussed. And nobody even really knew that happened until it just happened.
Well, it was a second thought. I mean, when the Pfizer vaccine came out, if you listen to the description, it's a vaccine, BN1 to whatever, embedded in lipid nanoparticles.
Right.
Now that's just like something you read past now, like, this jam's got strawberries in or something.
Right.
You know, it's just so obvious. Oh, of course it's got nanolipid particles. What the hell are those nanoparticles up to? Because nanotechnology is really extreme technology. It's technology that Prince Charles, someone who's like loves the World Economic Forum very much so, loves Klaus Schwab, gets involved quite a lot. He's someone who for years, for decades now, has talked about nanotechnology, especially in the early noughties and upwards, saying how we have to head towards nanotechnology. And I think we hear these things said from the royals and stuff before they become a reality, because they're being told it by their guys.
Boris Johnson.
Happen. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if there's anybody who deserves to be full of lipid nanoparticles, that would be Boris Johnson.
That's the point, exactly, right? It's all about us, you know. I question whether these things are even being actually given to these people in general. But in any case, it is something that is becoming ubiquitous, and that's alarming. Because going back to my original point, is it that they're just trying to right? The mentality from a lot of people that are deemed conspiracy theorists is, well, they're trying to get rid of us, right? And maybe that's not a shocking claim to make based on this history we just discussed, but maybe it's that they're actually now using this technology, at least in the way they perceive it, to alter us. And maybe, you know, it's supposed to get rid, but now we're just going to change them. And it's the same point. And that is exactly what we're talking about, right? And exactly what Tal Zaks from Moderna discussed in regard to mRNA vaccines, calling it what's the word you use? Not reimagining, that's in my head today, but reworking the fabric of life. Like they talk about genetic modification, and today that's
hacking the human cells. Yeah, hacking the human cells.
That's what it was. Hacking the software of life. That's what it was. And that's what he says about their technology. But yet today you talk about it. If I literally came out and said on a show, this vaccine hacks the software of life, they would censor me and call me a fake news conspiracy theorist, right? Yeah. It's incredible, but that's what it seems like they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, Forbes magazine can and stuff could say that. They can say all of that stuff.
Right.
They can say it in an article. They can put it on a video and say those words fine. But yeah, anybody else gets taken down because they've got to keep control of who's allowed to say what. I mean, we know what's going on. Other people don't necessarily know what's going on.
Right. Well, to wrap this up, I want to ask you one last point, just because I found this to be an interesting correlation to the timing of all of this. And that is, you know, we're talking about Klaus Schwab's family and even Klaus himself to a degree being involved with things that you could argue were, you know, in the vein of thought we're discussing here. And I find it really telling that just the other day we see this story. Tennessee man who served as a Nazi camp guard is deported to Germany. This 90-something-year-old man is, you know, oh, he did? Well, get him out of here. You know, it's like, and yet we have a discussion of people like Klaus Schwab or even people in the government that we have history showing that they're involved in much more serious ways, not just being a order taker, but being someone who gave orders. And yet, do you find it interesting this happened now? And what, you know what I mean? And why it was like a token to say, see, we're still upset about that. Or, you know, what are your thoughts?
I think those tokens are coming, have been coming for a long time. They've been trying to keep the memory of World War II and the Holocaust in your mind for more reasons than you should have it in your mind. I mean, people should be ashamed and disgusted. People should be horrified by it all. Yeah. But they want to use it as a tool
exactly.
to gain sympathy at all times and to say, look, we're on the right side. Look, we're battling Nazis. And these little bits of tidbits of news, they may not go in that well, but they may not like stay in there, but they sit around in the subconscious, and people will see it as, oh look, the state fighting against the Nazis of World War II. Well, that guy is old as hell. I bet you he could have been held to account before. So really the question is, who didn't hold him to account in the first place? And the answer will be the same people who don't want to be held to account.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. Well put, man. I mean, that's exactly the, you know, Epstein concept comes to mind, you know, where it's like, oh, suddenly now we're going to call him out. It's all these people knew beforehand. And it's this is the elitist society that we're talking about. And somebody like Klaus Schwab, who is clearly influential and clearly gathering the other influencers in a meeting and tell, you know, this is something that we should be concerned about. And for plenty of other reasons that I talk about every day, but just taking Johnny's research here and understanding that these people have a track record, a history of doing and driving toward the very things they pretend they're fighting should be more than enough to be resistant to what's happening here today. So thank you for joining us, Johnny. Anything else you want to leave us with here before we wrap up?
Hey, pleasure, man. Pleasure. We'll be doing loads more with the Unlimited Hangout. We'll be pushing out videos and doing other stuff. So keep a watch out. Other than that, everybody just get involved, become the researcher, go deep, as deep as you can, because every time you go deep, the next time you'll go deeper, and soon you'll build up the skills that'll allow you to do a lot of this for yourself, because there's loads of stories out there and they all need to be told.
Yes, exactly. That's what it's really about. And that's what they don't want you to do, because doing due diligence in regard to even people that you trust, including this show right now, and looking into the information for yourself is paramount today. Yep. So thank you for being here, brother. And as always, everybody out there, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.